With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Sabrina Halvorsen.
Good morning, and thank you for joining us today on the AgNet News Hour. Coming up later, H2A usage continues to grow, even with high costs. And we will also have this week's Almond Matters. But our top story today, Department of Agriculture research shows climate change may increase the insect population that poses a threat to the specialty crops industry. Led by the National Institute of Food and Agriculture and the University of California, the research shows populations of three major insect pests, including codling moth, peach twig borer, and oriental fruit moth, are projected to increase mainly due to the rising temperatures. The three pests are notorious for infesting most of the walnut, almond, and peach orchards of California, causing extensive damages by reducing the quality of fruits and nuts, that according to researchers. Climate change can lead to shifts in the timing of seasons, including warmer winters, earlier springs, and hotter summers, and these conditions can disrupt the natural life cycles of pests. The study revealed that due to temperature increases, these insects are expected to appear up to 28 days earlier in the spring, and the time between generations is expected to shorten by up to 19 days. Meanwhile, the recent United Nations Climate Change Conference gave an opportunity for U.S. leadership to showcase domestic agricultural approaches to address climate issues. Rod Bain reports.
In an annual event that for the first time provided a major focus on food production and agriculture as a climate mitigator and problem solver, Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack recognized that significance. In fact, the recent 28th United Nations Climate Change Conference set aside a day to recognize
Food and Agriculture Day, one of the special days, and highlighted at COP28.
His 3 days at the conference included participation in several sessions at high-level events, such as sessions updating the latest advances in the Agriculture Innovation Mission, AIM, for climate.
AIM for Climate Partners have more than doubled the total increased investment in climate-smart agriculture and food system innovation from $8 billion at COP27 to $17 billion today. We've more than doubled the number of innovation sprints since COP27 to 78, and we've more than doubled the number of partners since COP27 to over 600 now at COP28, including 55 government partners.
Another focal point of U.S. climate mitigation efforts, the Partnerships for Climate Smart Commodities, creating markets for commodities and services that are value added through climate smart production practices.
We specifically designed this opportunity to appeal to all types of farmers, from large farms to small family farm operations, across all major commodities, including a diverse range of farmer demographics. The project involves nearly 100 universities, including over 30 minority-serving institutions.
USDA is also part of a domestic initiative called America the Beautiful, with the goal of conserving 30% of U.S. lands and waters by the year 2030.
When it was structured, it was intended to reflect a broad range of efforts by ranchers and farmers, fishermen and women, forest owners, tribal nations, and communities to safeguard the health and the integrity of the lands and waters upon which all of us depend. For USDA, a critical part of the initiative is the inclusion of private working lands that are the backbone of many rural communities.
The secretary also conducted bilateral discussions while at COP28.
With my counterparts in Chile, France, the UK, and Mexico.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Canadian hog producers are not sure how trade will be affected when a California law starts up in a few weeks. Here's David Geiger.
There is less than a month left until California's Proposition 12 law goes into effect. It requires strict animal confinement rules for products sold within the state. The law has been fought in U.S. courts, but it doesn't just affect the U.S. Canada could feel a big impact, especially with close hog trade ties. Canada ships wean lean hogs, then buys U.S. pork products. Executive Director of the Canadian Pork Council, Stephen Heckbert, says it's seamless.
They're fully integrated. We have a common supply chain. We are the model of how you would say you want our two economies to work together. We get along well. We're competitors, but we also recognize that what's good for the United States is good for Canada and vice versa.
To deal with state legislation, the Canadian Pork Council is working with their government. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau was recently on the phone with California's governor. The challenge is trade dispute mechanisms cannot be used with the World Trade Organization or USMCA until Canada understands how it comes into force.
And the real problem, one of the other problems with Prop 12, is that's not still entirely clear everything that's going to be covered by it. So, for example, frozen products are apparently going to be exempt. So does that mean that more frozen products will flow into California? Ground pork is exempt. Sausages are exempt. And, you know, the trade in live animals between the two countries is also apparently exempt, according to California. So this is the real challenge, is that I'm not sure California has done a particularly good job of explaining to American producers or Canadian producers about what will and will not be permitted.
Because a law like Prop 12 requires tracking, California needs to hire and send off inspectors to ensure the pork they get is Prop 12 compliant. Heckpert says Canada would never allow that.
We would do that for the USDA, but there's no circumstance in which we'd allow a state-level official to come and inspect a plant in Canada. And there's nothing, I'm sure they're lovely people, but that's just not something that our federal government would ever allow.
Creating precedent by allowing individual state inspectors in allows more uncertainty, which Heckpert thinks would increase even after Prop 12 begins on January 1st.
There's 50 American states, and you can't operate a trade agreement with 50 individual states. We have to count on the United States government as being our trading partner. We've negotiated a free trade agreement with the United States, and from our perspective, that's the trade agreement that would govern commerce between our two countries, not a state regulation. There's either a national standard or there isn't.
Heckpert says this is the last thing struggling families need at a time of high food inflation and costs. He hopes California will avoid unintended consequences.
And this seems like a perfect opportunity for California to say, you know what, we're going to put it in abeyance for at least a year, and let's wait and see if the U.S. government comes up with an idea on how we're going to ensure that these kinds of individual state propositions just don't keep coming up and wrecking our trade relationship with Canada.
I'm David Geiger.
Don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you just need to catch the news at a different time, you can subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search AgNet NewsHour on your favorite podcast downloading app. This is the AgNet NewsHour. I'm Sabrina Halverson, and we will be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports, including our livestock report with Will Jordan, when we get back. You are listening to the AgNet NewsHour. The farmland market in 2023 saw some new highs in prices paid for acreage. Randy Dickhoot, farmland specialist with Agricultural Economic Insights, says buying land in the new year is going to require more borrowing than it did this year.
My take is, gosh, in a lot of parts of the Corn Belt, takes $3 million to buy a quarter section. And how many $3 million are there lying around in that neighborhood? So I think there's going to be next round of land buying coming up, a little more borrowed funds. And so that becomes more expensive. And that really makes a difference, because you're going to have to support that payment from other income from the farm. So higher interest rates, the cap rate expectation or return on that farmland is going to change, I think.
He says 2024 is going to look a lot different than the last few years.
We've been used to low interest rates, low treasury rates, where 2-3% return on farmland was acceptable. Now treasury rates are around 5%. Are they going to go high and stay higher longer? And so that expectation, I need a better return for that farmland. So do I get better rent, or does the value come down some? So I think that may play out, but there's still a lot of things going on.
The cost of farming will be a big factor in the farmland market.
Lower input prices, farm incomes, where will they land? Commodity prices are lower. World uncertainties. U.S. still has the most stable land market and so forth, so it's a place to invest and keep for the long term. But I think there will ultimately be some challenges on the farmland prices in 24. We'll see if it's just a softening, or I don't think it'll be more than that, but I think it'll give it another pause.
That's today's National Spotlight. Now here's Will Jordan with today's Livestock Report.
In today's livestock news, USDA's Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service's final rule on importation of fresh beef from Paraguay goes into effect Thursday, December 14th. Published in the Federal Register last month, the rule has drawn many questions from producers. Food safety and animal disease concerns, as well as the review of outdated data for the importation approval, has left industry organizations at odds with the rule as well. I recently sat down with Alexis Taylor, USDA Undersecretary of Trade and Foreign Agricultural Affairs, to ask the hard question of why.
Well, I think one thing to remember that's really important is, for every offensive interest I have to open up a market for U.S. producers, U.S. cattle ranchers, their trade is inherently two ways. And one of the things that we want the global trading system to be based on is transparent, rules-based, science-based regulatory systems. But that means we have to follow that as well in the United States. And in the example of Paraguay beef, but there are others as well, that as countries come to really probably one of the most attractive markets in the world, the United States, where we have high income, demanding consumers, discerning consumers, that when someone can meet our high standards around food safety, around animal health, that we do open our market to that in a way that makes sense. And so I think, you know, I really am focused on what for our livestock producers, where are their top markets? What are the barriers and how can we work to address them and knock them down so they have as many diverse markets as possible?
USDA provided a comment period on the rule earlier this year, with many of those comments being in opposition to Paraguayan beef imports to the U.S. According to a November press release, the National Cattlemen's Beef Association said, NCBA has repeatedly raised concerns with USDA over Paraguay's history of foot and mouth disease and the outdated information used to justify Paraguay's access to the U.S. market. NCBA is concerned that USDA's failure to use information from recent site visits in the risk assessment may pose great risk to the safety of the U.S. cattle herd. NCBA, in their press release, continued by saying, gaining beef access to the U.S. market has been the top priority for Paraguay in multiple rounds of trade discussions. Unfortunately, this is not the first time that a foreign country's beef access to the United States was a predetermined outcome and used as a bargaining tool for other U.S. interests. The dismissal of legitimate concerns from U.S. cattle producers is unacceptable, and USDA should halt this unscientific, unsafe rulemaking. While winning friends and allies in South America may be part of the long-term interest of U.S. diplomacy, it should not be done on the backs of U.S. cattle producers or by putting at risk the health and livelihood of the safest and most efficient cattle and beef production system in the world. In short, NCBA and many U.S. cattle producers are unpleased with the progression and approval of this rule. For AgNet West, I'm Will Jordan.
Don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you just need to catch the news at a different time, you can subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search AgNet News Hour on your favorite podcast downloading app. This is the AgNet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. We will be back in just a moment with more agriculture news. Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour. Here's more of the day's agriculture news. With today's AgNet West headlines, here's Brian German.
Management of the new Carpophilus truncatus beetle looks to require thorough sanitation in orchards. Cooperative Extension Specialist Houston Wilson said effective shredding will be needed as the pest appears very resilient.
You know, even just disking nuts under, that may be effective to some extent for navel orangeworm. There is evidence that navel orangeworm, when a mummy nut buried kind of superficially under the soil, the adult can still emerge. Work that they've carried out in Australia has shown that Carpophilus beetle is even more tolerant of burial. They had an experiment in one instance where they had mummy nuts buried close to 3 feet down in the soil, and the Carpophilus adults were still able to emerge up on the soil surface. So you really, it's very critical to get those nuts out of the tree, get them on the ground, and then shred them. So if you're flail mowing, you know, you may even want to make a second pass to really make sure you totally destroy that overwintering habitat.
The Agriculture Future of America and the National FFA Organization have formalized their long-standing partnership through a Memorandum of Understanding. The MOU, signed during AFA's Leaders Conference, highlights the shared goals and values of the two organizations in promoting school-based agricultural education. The partnership aims to create a seamless transition for FFA members into AFA, offering them access to leadership development programs, scholarships, internships, mentorship, and job opportunities. By addressing the human capital challenges in agriculture, the collaboration seeks to empower individuals with passion and skills, ensuring a skilled workforce for the industry's future. AFA and FFA also plan to collaborate on projects promoting agricultural education and leadership, providing opportunities for interaction with industry professionals. Despite an increase in the adverse effect wage rate, H-2A usage remains high. According to a Market Intel report, H-2A visa usage in the U.S. reached a record high of nearly 379,000 positions for fiscal year 2023. That marks a 2% increase from the year prior. While the national growth rate stands at 2%, over 10 states and territories experienced double-digit growth rates in certified positions in fiscal year 2023. Despite a slower growth rate compared to earlier years, the persistent rise in demand for H-2A workers continues, adding to the challenges faced by farmers and ranchers. The top 10 states with the most H-2A usage account for two-thirds of all certified positions. The report notes a nearly 19% rise in the required wage rate since fiscal year 2020, surpassing the hourly wage growth rate for all private employees. Researchers have a better understanding of how three-cornered alfalfa hopper impacts vineyards. Professor of plant pathology at Cornell University, Mark Fuchs, said they found that the presence of the pest varies between wet and dry years.
They spend time in vineyards where, at the time, there is little growing green plants outside vineyards. 21 was a dry year. What we found, they spend more time in vineyards because these were the only plants that were thriving because they are irrigated. So they don't like to spend time on vineyards. They only by default, when there is no other succulent food for them to feed upon, because nothing is green, everything is dead because it's so dry, then they spend time in vineyards. So that was quite interesting because we found their dietary preference was really distinct in 21 and 22.
The Organic Center and Organic Voices are hosting the 2024 Organic Gala at Natural Products Expo West in Anaheim and will celebrate achievements in promoting organic awareness. Themed an Organic Night Out, honoring the year's best in organic, the event will acknowledge individuals, brands, and businesses for their outstanding contributions in communicating organic benefits. The gala, a major fundraiser for both nonprofit organizations, will showcase interactive science exhibits highlighting organic research's impact on crop production, soil health, food safety, climate, and sustainability. For the first time, awards will recognize achievements in 8 categories, such as Best New Organic Product and Most Impactful Organic Research. The event aims to elevate organic awareness and encourage further industry growth. More information is available under the Events and Webinars tab at organic-center.org. I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
Soybean market conditions are putting downward pressure on U.S. soybean prices. Gary Crawford has more.
U.S. soybean growers will likely have fewer bushels to sell this marketing year, more competition from Brazil, and will suffer the triple whammy of lower prices than last season. That pretty much sums up the situation as outlined in USDA's latest soybean supply and demand report. First, hot, dry weather in northern Brazil has caused USDA to lower its forecast for Brazil's soybean crop by 2 million tons.
That still would be record large production.
USDA Outlook Chairman Mark Chekanowski, meanwhile, the U.S. crop will be down 3% from last year. However,
despite those tighter U.S. supplies, global supplies are increasing, and that's what's weighing on prices. That's why, even with the smaller supplies in the U.S. this year, U.S. farm prices are still expected to be down from last year.
Down by $1.30, or about 9% from last year at $12.90 a bushel. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
Groups like Clean Fuels Alliance and the American Soybean Association applauded representatives from California and Iowa for introducing the Bipartisan Renewable Fuel for Ocean-Going Vessels Act. The act designates renewable fuel used in ocean-going vessels as an additional renewable fuel, similar to jet fuel, under the Renewable Fuel Standard. This enables companies to preserve renewable identification number credits in the program. Kirk Kovarik, Vice President of the Federal Affairs for Clean Fuels, says international shipping companies and cruise lines are increasingly looking for low-carbon biodiesel to meet climate goals and consumer demand. He says this will remove a regulatory roadblock and enable biodiesel and renewable diesel producers to meet the low-carbon fuel needs of shipping companies at a competitive price. American Soybean Association President Darrell Case applauds the efforts to acknowledge marine vessels as a new and exciting market opportunity for agriculture. The RFS originally excluded fuels in ocean-going vessels from blending obligations. This is the AgNet NewsHour, and we will return in just a moment with more agriculture news. External parasites in your dairy herd can turn shiny coats tattered and reduce the comfort, efficiency, and performance of the herd. Chad Smith shares more.
Dr. Jennifer Roberts, professional services veterinarian with Boehringer Ingelheim, talks about what types of parasites can be a challenge for dairy producers.
Lice are typically going to be found around the neck, shoulders, or back of cattle, and there's a couple different kinds. We have biting lice and sucking lice. Those can be a real challenge because the cows get very itchy from it and can be uncomfortable. The other parasites that we worry about are mange mites. The most common ones that we see are the ones that live around the tail head and the hindquarters of the animal. Chorioptic mange is that classic tail head mange that we think of when we start to see those crusts and scabs around the tail head of the cows. There's another type of mange called sarcoptic mange, and this can cause more severe lesions than the mange mites, the chorioptic mange mites do. But the big concern with sarcoptic mange is that it's transmissible to humans.
She talks about why external parasites are a concern, especially in the winter.
And anything that impacts cow comfort is going to have an impact on their production in the herd. So cows that are spending a lot of time itching and trying to compensate for parasite infestations, they're going to be spending less time lying down, less time ruminating, and less time making milk. And so a comfortable cow is going to be a productive cow.
Monitoring for external parasites starts with observation.
We want to look for those visible signs. So the crusts and scabs around the tailhead area, any areas of hair loss. Sometimes we'll also see the cows maybe exhibiting signs of trying to itch themselves by licking the hair in the opposite direction. These are really helpful visible cues, but they're not always 100%. It's important to involve your veterinarian if you think you may have parasite in the herd.
Roberts talks about best practices when putting together a treatment plan.
Some farms will treat the whole herd once a year, and typically we're going to do this in the fall because as we have less day length and less exposure to sunlight, and the cow's hair starts to get a little bit longer in the wintertime to compensate for cooler temperatures, we do see an increase in parasite infestations. Other farms will treat at certain stages of production. So they will be pouring cows with a topical dewormer and anti-parasiticide year round. It's really important to work with a veterinarian to determine what's going to be the right approach for each individual herd.
She offers some additional deworming tips.
It's really important to consider what the needs are of the herd individually in consultation with the veterinarian, and then also really look at the product labels and see what parasites are covered by each individual product. Selecting a product that can cover that mange mite is important for ensuring not only the health of the herd, but also the employees that are working with those cows. We also want to make sure that we're minimizing animal movement, so not constantly bringing in new animals that haven't been poured with a topical dewormer.
Again, Dr. Jennifer Roberts is with Boehringer Ingelheim. Chad Smith reporting.
Certain common holiday foods can cause serious problems for dogs or cats that get into those foods. Gary Crawford has more.
While you are hosting a holiday party or meal, your dog or cat may be prowling around there saying,
"All I want for Christmas is food."
Food, yeah, but a lot of party foods can be dangerous to your pet, and not just chocolate. Kansas State University veterinarian Dr. Susan Nelson says you'd be surprised at the list of foods and food ingredients that can be toxic to dogs, cats, or both. For example, foods that contain the sugar-free sweetener xylitol.
It causes low blood sugar and liver failure.
And it doesn't take much to do irreparable harm.
And people don't think about it because it can be in baked goods. It can be in our sugar-free candies. It can also be in some of our medications, things like that as well.
It's in many sugar-free chewing gums also. And in fact, she's had cases where dogs have gone into the room where partygoers have put their coats and purses and such, gotten into those coats and purses, started eating the chewing gum and died from it. And this xylitol thing is mostly a problem for dogs. Also, especially for dogs, the fatty parts of meats can be a problem.
All those fatty parts can cause what we call pancreatitis, which can become life-threatening for them as well. And then some of our gravies and things like that are made with onion powder, which is a lot more concentrated than just plain onion. And they can have garlic powder and things in them as well. And so for both cats and dogs, that can also be an issue. as far as causing a type of anemia that they can get.
But the list is longer. There are more foods that can cause problems for pets. Do you put out nuts like macadamias, almonds, walnuts, pecans? Those can cause all kinds of gastrointestinal problems, from just making the dog throw up to conditions that could really be dangerous and result in some very expensive surgery.
And then raisins, which are going to be in a lot of the holiday foods, and grapes, can be toxic to dogs.
And if you're baking things using raw bread dough,
that can cause serious problems for dogs if they ingest the raw bread dough as well.
Quite a list there. Now, you may think that Dr. Nelson's list of bad foods for dogs and cats goes a little far. Maybe she's just a worrywart or an alarmist, but she says she has seen and treated these exact problems.
Oh, yeah, and I was out in private practice for 13 years as well, so, yep.
So Dr. Nelson's advice to party hosts, do your best to keep your party foods out of the reach of your pets, or keep the pets out of reach of the foods. And also, if the pets are running around during the party or the meal, ask your guests, please don't feed them.
It will just encourage begging behavior, and you don't know what they might be feeding them. And there again, some of these can be more problematic than others, depending what pieces are slipping them.
Or if the pets rule the house, maybe let the pets eat their food, have the guests beg for food from the pets. How about that, huh?
That would be another way to do it.
Yeah, not a good way, though, right, Dougie?
All
right.
All I want for Christmas is food.
Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture, Washington.
Don't forget, if you have missed any of our morning shows, or if you just need to catch your ag news at a different time, you can subscribe to our podcast and find statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search AgNet NewsHour on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's AgNet NewsHour, and it is available on both Apple and Android devices. Welcome back to the AgNet NewsHour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. In this week's Almond Matters, brought to you by Valent USA, we talk about what growers have top of mind for preparing for the next season. Here's Brian German.
In this week's Almond Matters segment, Field Market Development Specialist with Valent USA, Todd Birkdahl, is with us here again this morning. And today we're finishing up our conversation about dormancy programs. And so, Todd, let's get into it here with what growers are getting after here in the middle of December.
Well, the weeds and the dormant applications are the two things. You know, I mean, a lot of guys have foregone making dormant applications because, you know, the past 8, 9, 10 years it's been warm. And you know, we haven't had rain. Last year was a game changer because of the rain. But having a dormant application on, and some people don't recommend it. I'm one that does. I think an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. Anything you can do to go in there, you know, you can do a leaf drop dormant application. Put some zinc on the trees. You know, get a little foliar nutrition into the trees. So when they do wake up in the spring, they're ready to go. Some guys use urea and zinc together, copper fungicide as well for disease control. We've had a lot of disease this year. Scale was problematic across the board. Rust, which hasn't shown up in several years, became a problem. Rust is problematic because it produced so many pustules and spores, basically, are there. And so putting the lights out on those with a contact fungicide is really, really key. So you can get with a dormant application, you're actually targeting a whole spectrum of problems, not only navel orangeworm. You can effectively kill mites, overwintering mites, the navel orangeworm itself, leaf rollers, leaf folders, the pink twig borer, several lepidopteran pests a lot of them are minor. But, you know, broad spectrum application there really knocks the population down. And then the fungicide component as well. And then, of course, your nutrition. So it's kind of a cocktail of products that you're putting on. And I'm definitely a proponent of it. You know, it's where I went to school. I was back at Fresno State 30 years ago. It was standard operating procedures for dormant application. I mean, that was talked about in all the orchard management and vineyard as well. So I'm definitely a proponent. I've seen the value of it.
And that sort of echoes what we had talked about last week, and there being value in getting ahead of issues, maybe even despite the cost. And when you're taking a proactive approach, what's a good timing for that?
Typically, I like to do dormant applications after you've gotten some moisture out there. You know, when the field has got moisture content, you know, actually spraying right after a rain is really a good time if you can get back in the field. Things are already wet. The water helps for penetration. You're spraying basically water and oil, and then the actives, and you're spraying the foliar application. So having everything already pre-wet makes it easier to get penetration into the plant tissues. Think of it as, you know, sopping up a wet spill on the floor. If you use a dry cloth, it does all right. But if you use one that's already wet, that's wrung out, it does a better job of cleaning it up. So especially if there's, you know, the dry one works fine, but it just usually smears it around. The wet one actually, you know, cleans up the mess, the spill. So the same thing is, it's, there's properties of water, you know, and so getting your spray applications onto a field that's already been rained on is, I think it's better than not. I think it's more effective that way. As far as the weeds go, is definitely, you need to have moisture on top of those herbicides to drive them in and activate them in the soil. They basically lock up in the clay colloids of the upper layers of soil, and getting enough water to get them down to where the weed seeds are germinating is really key. If you just get a little bit of water, you get some incorporation, but having at least quarter to even a half an inch of water on top of a herbicide really does a good job of getting it, products incorporated into that upper region, that upper soil profile. And by upper soil profile, I mean the upper half inch of soil. That's where most of your weeds are going to be coming from. And you know that right now we've had a little bit of rain, ground still for the most part drier, but getting that pre-emergent down in advance of the rains is really key to keeping the orchard floor clean, keeping weeds at bay. And an ounce of prevention right now is literally worth a pound of cure later on. You know, you can put down a pre-emergent and not have to spray it three or four times with contact materials and do catch up later on in the spring. So getting those pre-emergent herbicides down now is really key. Again, I work for Valent, so I kind of lean towards our product line, but Chateau is, we've got a new formulation that works really well, easy. It's called Chateau Easy. It's a liquid, and it does a pretty good job on a whole lot of broadleaves, a couple of grasses, but in combination, there really isn't any silver bullets as far as one product working across all the weeds that a person might encounter. But the foundational products are ones that stick around. Chateau's got that history of being a really good product for that. And mix it with a grass herbicide. I like Chateau and Prowl H2O together. That works really, really well. Prowl picks up most, if not all, the small-seeded broadleaves and grasses, and Chateau does a number on most of the broadleaves. So by putting those two together, you do a really good job. Also, Chateau Matrix, Chateau Allion at reduced rates of Allion is at reduced rates. I mean, like, you know, 2 or 3 ounces, no more than 3 ounces of Allion, a couple ounces of Allion with a full rate of Chateau. It also looks really well, really good for control.
Thank you, Brian, and thank you to Valent USA for this week's Almond Matters. This is the AgNet News Hour, and we will return in just a moment. You are listening to the AgNet News Hour, and now for more news, it's simple economics. A shrinking national beef herd plus growing consumer demand means a strong cattle market for years to come. For the nation's dairy cattle producers, this means great opportunities to breed for beef on dairy crosses. Bob Severa explains how.
With the nation's beef cow herd inventory the smallest it's been since the 1960s, the beef industry needs more cattle to keep up with consumer demand, and it needs them fast. John Meyer, CEO of Holstein Association USA, says the registered Holstein cow has provided value to the beef industry for a long time, and she plays an even greater role in today's growing beef on dairy trends.
Some of the very early research on this and substantiated research shows how important the Holstein cow is to the beef supply in this country. And I learned and saw statistical information that shows the best beef in all of the different tests that they have is actually a straight Holstein cow.
By crossing Holstein cows with beef breeds, many dairy farmers can achieve high choice or even prime grading animals. That results in significant profit potential. But a profit on that line of thinking can go even further.
If people want to start developing a new profit center on their dairy where they're actually raising some of these animals and feeding them themselves so that that cow spends all of its time on that farm, its entire life until it goes to harvest where everything is controllable.
Dr. Dale Warner is an animal science professor at Texas Tech University. He says benefits from beef-on-dairy programs go both ways, especially while the beef industry recovers from drought-forced liquidation.
The beef-on-dairy crosses are definitely needed by both the dairy and beef industries today. Of course, the dairy industry benefiting for producing a more profitable calf from those cows, and the beef industry is in a predicament now because the beef cow herd has shrunk.
Beef on dairy crosses simply make cattle operations more efficient, and that translates to more profit.
Utilizing an alternative animal to the traditional straight red dairy animal improves feed efficiency in the feedlot, produces more beef at the end of the day with heavier carcass weights and higher red meat yields.
The professor says the added information and genomic data that comes with U.S. registered Holsteins is also a major benefit.
The beef industry has never experienced this amount of information coming in with the cattle that are coming into feedlots and the harvest environment. The ability to use genomics and genomic testing in order to better select animals for things like carcass merit, growth potential, feed efficiency, marbling ability, other carcass traits like ribeye area and indicators of muscling is something that we've never had before.
Continued development in efforts like Holstein Association USA's Wholesome Program, which offers sire recommendations when breeding registered Holsteins with Sim Angus bulls, could also help keep generations of family farms in the family. And the real advantage goes to registered Holstein breeders.
Any way you slice it, Holstein has to be in the mix when it comes to the beef on dairy business, and I think those opportunities are going to be really, really good as we go forward.
For Holstein Association USA, I'm Bob Cervera.
We are seeing a time of soft demand for cotton. Gary Crawford reports.
If you grow cotton, you're certainly painfully aware of this.
Demand is relatively soft compared to last year.
USDA Outlook Board Chairman Mark Jekinowski some numbers. First, the U.S. cotton crop projected to come in at only 12.8 million bales, down 12% from last year. Marketing that cotton could be hard if demand is soft, and that's true. USDA forecasting that U.S. mills are only going to use 1.9 million bales of cotton.
Down at levels last seen in the late 1880s.
Not the 1980s, the 1880s. So demand for cotton is down here in the U.S., but also
there's concerns about China demand, global demand tied to the general overall health of the global economy.
And so cotton prices are expected to languish in the 77 cent a pound range.
Down fairly substantially from last year,
when cotton was bringing an average of just under 85 cents a pound. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
Meanwhile, there's a fairly strong market for U.S. rice. USDA Outlook Board Chairman Mark Jekinowski.
Globally, looking at this year relative to last, production is actually up. Currently forecast global production at just over 518 million tons, and that's up about 5 million tons from last year. Ending stocks are still tight. Demand is strong. Consumption has been strong. So global ending stocks are actually forecast to be down 7 million tons. So we have global ending stocks right now at 167.8 million tons, and that would be down from 174.7 million tons last year. So even though production is up, total supplies, in a sense, are tightening up year over year.
That's today's top agriculture news. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Thank you for sharing your morning with us.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at AgNet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Brian German and Sabrina Halverson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. AgNet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.